The following program is a production of Sight into Sound Radio. Hello and welcome to the second reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. I'm Anna McLean. Before we begin, let me explain that this book is read in its entirety. However, some of the reading may still contain explicit descriptions that some people may find objectionable. For those of you who did not hear the last reading of this book, let me bring you up to date. France, 1939. In the quiet village of Carvaux, Vianne Mauriac, with her daughter Sophie, say goodbye to her husband Antoine as he heads for the front. Meanwhile, her sister Isabel is in Paris, having been expelled from yet again another school. She is returning from a picnic with her boyfriend, Christophe. Now we continue with The Nightingale. "You read too much," Christophe said, chewing on a stalk of hay. "What is that, a romantic novel?" She rolled toward him, snapping the book shut. It was about Edith Cavell, a nurse in the Great War, a hero. "I could be a war hero, Christophe," he laughed. "A girl, a hero, absurd." Isabel got to her feet quickly, yanking up her hat and white kid gloves. "Don't be mad," he said, grinning up at her. "I'm just tired of the war talk, and it's a fact that women are useless in war. Your job is to wait for our return." He propped his cheek in one hand and peered up at her through the mop of blonde hair that fell across his eyes. In his yachting-style blazer and wide-legged white pants, he looked exactly like what he was, a privileged university student who was unused to work of any kind. Many students his age had volunteered to leave university and join the army, not Christophe. Isabel hiked up the hill and through the orchard, out to the grassy knoll where his open-topped Panhard was parked. She was already behind the wheel with the engine running when Christophe appeared, a sheen of sweat on his conventionally handsome face, the empty picnic basket hanging from his arm. "Just throw that stuff in the back," she said with a bright smile. "You're not driving." "It appears that I am. Now get in." "It's my automobile, Isabel." "Well, to be precise, and I know how important the facts are to you, Christophe, it's your mother's automobile, and I believe a woman should drive a woman's automobile." Isabel tried not to smile when he rolled his eyes and muttered, "Fine," and leaned over to place the basket behind Isabel's seat. Then, moving slowly enough to make his point, he walked around the front of the automobile and took his place in the seat beside her. He had no sooner clicked the door shut than she put the automobile in gear and stomped on the gas. The automobile hesitated for a second, then lurched forward, spewing dust and smoke as it gathered speed. "Mon Dieu, Isabel, slow down!" She held on to her flapping straw hat with one hand and clutched the steering wheel with the other. She barely slowed as she passed other motorists. "Mon Dieu, slow down," he said again. Certainly he must know that she had no intention of complying. "A woman can go to war these days," Isabel said when the Paris traffic finally forced her to slow down. "I could be an ambulance driver, maybe, or I could work on breaking secret codes, or charming the enemy into telling me a secret location or plan. Remember that game?" "War is not a game, Isabel." "I believe I know that, Christophe, but if it does come, I can help. That's all I'm saying." On the Rue de l'Amiral de Coligny, she had to slam on the brakes to avoid hitting a lorry. A convoy from the Comédie Française was pulling out of the Louvre Museum. In fact, there were lorries everywhere and uniformed gendarmes directing traffic. Sandbags were piled up around several buildings and monuments to protect from attack, of which there had been none since France joined the war. "Why were there so many French policemen out here?" "Odd," Isabel mumbled, frowning. Christophe craned his neck to see what was going on. "They're moving treasures out of the Louvre," he said. Isabel saw a break in traffic and sped up. In no time, she had pulled up in front of her father's bookshop and parked. She waved goodbye to Christophe and ducked into the shop. It was long and narrow, lined from floor to ceiling with books. Over the years, her father had tried to increase his inventory by building freestanding bookcases. The result of his improvements was the creation of a labyrinth. The stacks led one this way and that, deeper and deeper within. At the very back were the books for tourists. Some stacks were well-lit, some in shadows. There weren't enough outlets to illuminate every nook and cranny. but her father knew every title on every shelf. "You're late," he said, looking up from his desk in the back. He was doing something with the printing press, probably making one of his books of poetry, which no one ever purchased. His blunt-tipped fingers were stained blue. "I suppose boys are more important to you than employment." She slid onto the stool behind the cash register. In the week she'd lived with her father, she made it a point not to argue back, although Acuisi gnawed at her. She tapped her foot impatiently. Words, phrases, excuses clamored to be spoken aloud. It was hard not to tell him how she felt, but she knew how badly he wanted her gone, so she held her tongue. "Do you hear that?" he said some time later. Had she fallen asleep? Isabel sat up. She hadn't heard her father approach, but he was beside her now, frowning. There was a strange sound in the bookshop, to be sure. Dust fell from the ceiling. The bookcases clattered slightly, making a sound like chattering teeth. Shadows passed in front of the leaded glass display windows at the entrance. Hundreds of them. People? So many of them? Papa went to the door. Isabel slid off a stool and followed him. As he opened the door, she saw a crowd running down the street, filling the sidewalks. "What in the world?" Papa muttered. Isabel pushed past Papa, elbowed her way into the crowd. A man bumped into her so hard she stumbled, and he didn't even apologize. More people rushed past them. "What is it? What happened?" she asked a florid, wheezing man who was trying to break free of the crowd. "The Germans are coming into Paris," he said. "We must leave. I was in the Great War. I know." Isabel scoffed. "Germans in Paris? Impossible." He ran away, bobbing from side to side, weaving, his hands fisting and unfisting at his sides. "We must get home," Papa said, locking the bookshop door. "It can't be true," she said. "The worst can always be true," Papa said grimly. "Stay close to me," he added, moving into the crowd. Isabel had never seen such panic. All up and down the street, lights were coming on. Automobiles were starting. Doors were slamming shut. People screamed to one another and reached out, trying to stay connected in the melee. Isabel stayed close to her father. The pandemonium in the streets slowed them down. The metro tunnels were too crowded to navigate, so they had to walk all the way. It was nearing nightfall when they finally made it home. At their apartment building, it took her father 2 tries to open the main door. His hands were shaking so badly. Once in, they ignored the rickety cage elevator and hurried up 5 flights of stairs to their apartment. "Don't turn on the lights," her father said harshly as he opened the door. Isabel followed him into the living room and went past him to the window, where she lifted the blackout shade, peering out. From far away came a droning sound. As it grew louder, the window rattled, sounding like ice in a glass. She heard a high whistling sound only seconds before she saw the black flotilla in the sky, like birds flying in formation. Aeroplanes. "Boches," her father whispered. "Germans." German aeroplanes flying over Paris. The whistling sound increased, became like a woman's scream, and then, somewhere, maybe in the second arrondissement, she thought, a bomb exploded in a flash of eerie bright light, and something caught fire. The air raid siren sounded. Her father wrenched the curtain shut and led her out of the apartment and down the stairs. Their neighbors were all doing the same thing, carrying coats and babies and pets down the stairs to the lobby and then down the narrow, twisting stone stairs that led to the cellar. In the dark, they sat together, crowded in close. The air stank of mildew and body odor and fear. That was the sharpest scent of all. The bombing went on and on and on, screeching and droning. The cellar walls vibrating around them. Dust fell from the ceiling. A baby started crying and couldn't be soothed. "Shut that child up, please," someone snapped. "I'm trying, monsieur. He's scared." "So are we all." After what felt like an eternity, silence fell. It was almost worse than the noise. What if Paris was left? By the time the all clear sounded, Isabel felt numb. Isabel, she wanted her father to reach out for her, to take her hand and comfort her, even if it was just for a moment. But he turned away from her and headed up the dark, twisting basement stairs. In their apartment, Isabel went immediately to the window, peering past the shade to look for the Eiffel Tower. It was still there, rising above a wall of thick black smoke. "Don't stand by the windows," he said. She turned slowly. The only light in the room was from his torch, a sickly yellow thread in the dark. "Paris won't fall," she said. He said nothing, frowned. She wondered if he was thinking of the Great War and what he'd seen in the trenches. Perhaps his injury was hurting again, aching in sympathy with the sound of falling bombs and hissing flames. "Go to bed, Isabel." "How can I possibly sleep at a time like this?" He sighed. "You will learn that a lot of things are possible." Chapter 5. They had been lied to by their government. They'd been assured, time and time again, that the Maginot Line would keep the Germans out of France. Lies. Neither concrete and steel nor French soldiers could stop Hitler's march, and the government had run from Paris like thieves in the night. It was said they were in Tours, strategizing. But what good did strategy do when Paris was to be overrun by the enemy? "Are you ready?" "I am not going, Papa. I have told you this." She had dressed for travel, as he'd asked, in a red polka-dot summer dress and low heels. "We will not have this conversation again, Isabel. The Humberts will be here soon to pick you up. They will take you as far as Tours. From there, I leave it to your ingenuity to get to your sister's house. Lord knows you have always been adept at running away." "So you throw me out again?" "Enough of this, Isabel. Your sister's husband is at the front. She is alone with her daughter. You will do as I say. You will leave Paris." Did he know how this hurt her? Did he care? "You've never cared about Vianne or me, and she doesn't want me any more than you do. You're going," he said. "I want to stay and fight, Papa, to be like Edith Cavell." He rolled his eyes. "You remember how she died? Executed by the Germans. Papa, please." "Enough. I have seen what they can do, Isabel. You have not. If it's that bad, you should come with me." "And leave the apartment and bookshop to them?" He grabbed her by the hand and dragged her out of the apartment and down the stairs, her straw hat and valise banging into the wall, her breath coming in gasps. At last he opened the door and pulled her out onto the Avenue de la Bourdonnais. Chaos. Dust. Crowds. The street was a living, breathing dragon of humanity, inching forward, wheezing dirt, honking horns, people yelling for help, babies crying, and the smell of sweat heavy in the air. Automobiles clogged the area, each burdened beneath boxes and bags. People had taken whatever they could find, carts and bicycles and even children's wagons. Those who couldn't find or afford the petrol or an automobile or a bicycle walked. Hundreds, thousands of women and children held hands, shuffled forward, carrying as much as they could hold. Suitcases, picnic baskets, pets. Already the very old and very young were falling behind. Isabel didn't want to join this hopeless, helpless crowd of women and children and old people. While the young men were away, dying for them at the front, their families were leaving, heading south or west, although really, what made any of them think it would be safer there? Hitler's troops had already invaded Poland and Belgium and Czechoslovakia. The crowd engulfed them. A woman ran into Isabel, mumbled pardon, and kept walking. Isabel followed her father. "I can be useful, please. I'll be a nurse or drive an ambulance. I can roll bandages or even stitch up a wound." Beside them, a horn augured. Her father looked past her, and she saw the relief that lifted his countenance. Isabel recognized that look. It meant he was getting rid of her. Again. "They are here," he said. "Don't send me away," she said. "Please." He maneuvered her through the crowd to where a dusty black automobile was parked. It had a saggy, stained mattress strapped to its roof, along with a set of fishing poles and a rabbit cage with the rabbit still inside. The boot was open, but also strapped down. Inside, she saw a jumble of baskets and suitcases and lamps. Inside the automobile, Monsieur Humbert's pale, plump fingers clutched the steering wheel as if the automobile were a horse that might bolt at any second. He was a pudgy man who spent his days in the butcher shop near Papa's bookstore. His wife, Patricia, was a sturdy woman who had the heavy jowled peasant look one saw so often in the country. She was smoking a cigarette and staring out the window as if she couldn't believe what she was seeing. Monsieur Humbert rolled down his window and poked his face into the opening. "Hello, Julianne. She is ready?" Papa nodded. "She is ready. Merci, Edouard." Patricia leaned over to talk to Papa through the open window. "We are only going as far as Orleans, and she has to pay her share of petrol." "Of course." Isabel couldn't leave. It was cowardly. Wrong. "Papa!" "Au revoir," he said, firmly enough to remind her that she had no choice. He nodded toward the car, and she moved numbly toward it. She opened the back door and saw three small, dirty girls lying together, eating crackers and drinking from bottles and playing with dolls. The last thing she wanted was to join them, but she pushed her way in, made a space for herself among these strangers that smelled vaguely of cheese and sausage, and closed the door. Twisting around in her seat, she stared at her father through the back window. His face held her gaze. She saw his mouth bend ever so slightly downward. It was the only hint that he saw her. The crowd surged around him like water around a rock, until all she could see was the wall of bedraggled strangers coming up behind the car. Isabel faced forward in her seat again. Out her window, a young woman stared back at her, wild eyes, hair a bird's nest, an infant suckling on her breast. The car moved slowly, sometimes inching forward, sometimes stopped for long periods of time. Isabel watched her countrymen, countrywomen, shuffle past her, looking dazed and terrified and confused. Every now and then, one of them would pound on the car bonnet or boot, begging for something. They kept the windows rolled up, even though the heat in the car was stifling. At first, she was sad to be leaving. And then her anger bloomed, growing hotter even than the air in the back of the stinking car. She was so tired of being considered disposable. First, her papa had abandoned her, and then Vianne had pushed her aside. She closed her eyes to hide tears she couldn't suppress. In the darkness that smelled of sausage and sweat and smoke, with the children arguing beside her, she remembered the first time she'd been sent away. The long train ride, Isabel stuffed in beside Vianne, who did nothing but sniff and cry and pretend to sleep. And then Madame, looking down her copper pipe of a nose, saying, "They will be no trouble." Although she'd been young, only 4, Isabel thought she'd learn what alone meant. But she'd been wrong. In the 3 years she'd lived at Le Jardin, she'd at least had a sister, even if Vianne was never around. Isabel remembered peering down from the upstairs window, watching Vianne and her friends from a distance, praying to be remembered, to be invited. And then, when Vianne had married Antoine and fired Madame Doom, not a real name, of course, but certainly the truth, Isabel had believed she was a part of the family, but not for long. When Vianne had her miscarriage, it was instantly, "Goodbye, Isabel." 3 weeks later, at 7, she'd been in her first boarding school. That was when she really learned about alone. "You, Isabel, did you bring food?" Patricia asked. She was turned around in her seat, peering at Isabel. "No." "Wine?" "I brought money and clothes and books." "Books," Patricia said dismissively and turned back around. "That should help." Isabel looked out the window again. What other mistakes had she already made? Hours passed. The automobile made its slow, agonizing way south. Isabel was grateful for the dust. It coated the window and obscured the terrible, depressing scene. People. Everywhere. In front of them. Behind them. Beside them. So thick was the crowd that the automobile could only inch forward in fits and starts. It was like driving through a swarm of bees that pulled apart for a second and then swarmed again. The sun was punishingly hot. It turned the smelly automobile interior into an oven and beat down on the women outside who were shuffling toward what? No one knew what exactly was happening behind them or where safety lay ahead. The car lurched forward and stopped hard. Isabel hit the seat in front of her. The children immediately started to cry for their mother.
"Merde," Monsieur Humbert muttered.
"Monsieur Humbert," Patricia said primly, "the children." An old woman pounded on the car's bonnet as she shuffled past. "That's it, then, Madame Humbert," he said. "We are out of petrol." Patricia looked like a landed fish. "What?" "I stopped at every chance along the way. You know I did. We have no more petrol, and there's none to be had." "But, well, what are we to do?"
We'll find a place to stay. Perhaps I can convince my brother to come fetch us. Robert opened his automobile door, being careful not to hit anyone ambling past, and stepped out onto the dusty dirt road. See, there, Etam's is not far ahead. We'll get a room and a meal, and it will all look better in the morning. Isabel sat upright. Surely she had fallen asleep and missed something. Were they going to simply abandon the automobile? You think we can walk to Tours? Patricia turned around in her seat. She looked as drained and hot as Isabel felt. Perhaps one of your books can help you. Certainly they were a smarter choice than bread or water. Come, girls, out of the automobile. Isabel reached down for the valise at her feet. It was wedged in tightly and required some effort to extricate. With a growl of determination, she finally yanked it free and opened the car door and stepped out. She was immediately surrounded by people, pushed and shoved and cursed at. Someone tried to yank her suitcase out of her grasp. She fought for it, hung on. As she clutched it to her body, a woman walked past her, pushing a bicycle laden with possessions. The woman stared at Isabel hopelessly, her dark eyes revealing exhaustion. Someone else bumped into Isabel. She stumbled forward and almost fell. Only the thicket of bodies in front of her saved her from going to her knees in the dust and dirt. She heard the person beside her apologize, and Isabel was about to respond when she remembered the Humberts. She shoved her way around to the other side of the car, crying out, "Monsieur Humbert!" There was no answer, just the ceaseless pounding of feet on the road. She called out Patricia's name, but her cry was lost in the thud of so many feet, so many tires crunching on the dirt. People bumped her, pushed past her. If she fell to her knees, she'd be trampled and die here, alone in the throng of her countrymen. Clutching the smooth leather handle of her valise, she joined the march toward Etampes. She was still walking hours later when night fell. Her feet ached, a blister burned with every step. Hunger walked beside her, poking her insistently with its sharp little elbow. But what could she do about it? She'd packed for a visit with her sister, not an endless exodus. She had her favorite copy of Madame Bovary and the book everyone was reading, Autant and Import Lavin, and some clothes, no food or water. She expected that the whole journey would last a few hours, certainly not that she would be walking to Caravaux. At the top of a small rise, she came to a stop. Moonlight revealed thousands of people walking beside her, in front of her, behind her, jostling her, bumping into her, shoving her forward until she had no choice but to stumble along with them. Hundreds more had chosen this hillside as a resting place. Women and children were camped along the side of the road, in fields and gutters and gullies. The dirt road was littered with broken-down automobiles and belongings, forgotten, discarded, stepped on, too heavy to carry. Women and children lay entangled in the grass or beneath trees or alongside ditches, asleep, their arms coiled around each other. Isabel came to an exhausted halt on the outskirts of Etampes. The crowd spilled out in front of her, stumbling onto the road to town. And she knew there would be nowhere to stay in Etampes and nothing to eat. The refugees who had arrived before her would have moved through the town like locusts, buying every foodstuff on the shelves. There wouldn't be a room available. Her money would do her no good. So what should she do? Head southwest toward Tours and Caravaux. What else? As a girl, she'd studied maps of this region in her quest to return to Paris. She knew this landscape, if only she could think. She peeled away from the crowd, headed toward the collection of moonlit gray stone buildings in the distance, and picked her way carefully through the valley. All around her, people were seated in the grass or sleeping beneath blankets. She could hear them moving, whispering, hundreds of them, thousands. On the far side of the field, she found a trail that ran south along a low stone wall. Turning onto it, she found herself alone. She paused, letting the feel of that settle through her, calm her. Then she began walking again. After a mile or so, the trail led her into a copse of spinning trees. She was deep in the woods, trying not to focus on the pain in her toe, the ache in her stomach, the dryness in her throat, when she smelled smoke and roasting meat, Hunger stripped her resolve and made her careless. She saw the orange glow of the fire and moved toward it. At the last minute, she realized her danger and stopped. A twig snapped beneath her foot. "You may as well come over," said a male voice. "You move like an elephant through the woods." Isabel froze. She knew she'd been stupid. There could be danger here for a girl alone. "If I wanted you dead, you'd be dead." That was certainly true. He could have come upon her in the dark and slit her throat. She'd been paying attention to nothing except the gnawing in her empty stomach and the aroma of roasting meat. "You can trust me." She stared into the darkness, trying to make him out. "Couldn't. You would say that if the opposite were true, too." A laugh. "Whee. And now come here. I have a rabbit on the fire." She followed the glow of firelight over a rocky gully and uphill. The tree trunks around her looked silver in the moonlight. She moved lightly, ready to run in an instant. At the last tree between her and the fire, she stopped. A young man sat by the fire, leaning back against a rough trunk, one leg thrust forward, one bent at the knee. He was probably only a few years older than Isabel. It was hard to see him well in the orange glow. He had longish, stringy black hair that looked unfamiliar with a comb or soap, and clothes so tattered and patched. She was reminded of the war refugees who so recently shuffled through Paris, hoarding cigarettes and bits of paper and empty bottles, begging for change or help. He had the pale, unwholesome look of someone who never knew where his next meal was coming from, and yet he was offering her food. "I hope you are a gentleman," she said from her place in the darkness. He laughed. "I'm sure you do." She stepped into the light cast by the fire. "Sit," he said. She sat across from him in the grass. He leaned around the fire and handed her the bottle of wine. She took a long drink, so long he laughed as she handed him back the bottle and wiped wine from her chin. "What a pretty drunkard you are." She had no idea how to answer that. He smiled. "Gaétan Dubois. My friends call me Gaët. Isabel Rossignol." "Ah, a nightingale." She shrugged. It was hardly a new observation. Her surname meant nightingale. Maman had called Vianne and Isabel her nightingales as she kissed them good night. It was one of Isabel's few memories of her. "Why are you leaving Paris? A man like you should stay and fight." "They opened the prison. Apparently it is better to have us fight for France than sit behind bars when the Germans storm through." "You are in prison? Does that scare you?" "No, it's just unexpected." "You should be scared," he said, pushing the stringy hair out of his eyes. "Anyway, you are safe enough with me. I have other things on my mind. I am going to check on my maman and sister and then find a regiment to join. I'll kill as many of those bastards as I can." "You're lucky," she said with a sigh. Why was it so easy for men in the world to do as they wanted and so difficult for women? "Come with me." Isabel knew better than to believe him. "You only ask because I'm pretty and you think I'll end up in your bed if I stay," she said. He stared across the fire at her. It cracked and hissed as fat dripped onto the flames. He took a long drink of wine and handed the bottle back to her. Near the flames, their hands touched, the barest brushing of skin on skin. "I could have you in my bed right now, if that's what I wanted." "Not willingly," she said, swallowing hard, unable to look away. "Willingly," he said in a way that made her skin prickle and made breathing difficult. "But that's not what I meant, or what I said. I asked you to come with me to fight." Isabel felt something so new she couldn't quite grasp it. She knew she was beautiful. It was simply a fact to her. People said it whenever they met her. She saw how men gazed at her with unabashed desire, remarking on her hair or green eyes or plump lips, how they looked at her breasts. She saw her beauty reflected in women's eyes, too. Girls at school who didn't want her to stand too near the boys they liked and judged her to be arrogant before she'd even spoken a word. Beauty was just another way to discount her, to not see her. She had grown used to getting attention in other ways, and she wasn't a complete innocent when it came to passion, either. Hadn't the good sisters of St. Francis expelled her for kissing a boy during Mass? But this felt different. He saw her beauty, even in the half-light, she could tell, but he looked past it. Either that, or he was smart enough to see that she wanted to offer more to the world than a pretty face. "I could do something that matters," she said quietly. Of course you could. I could teach you to use a gun and a knife. I need to go to Caraval and make sure my sister is well. Her husband is at the front. He gazed at her across the fire, his expression intent. We will see your sister in Caraval and my mother in Poitiers, and then we will be off to join the war. He made it sound like such an adventure, no different from running off to join the circus, as if they would see men who swallowed swords and fat women with beards along the way. It was what she'd been looking for all of her life. A plan, then, she said, unable to hide her smile.
Chapter 6. The next morning, Isabel blinked awake to see sunlight gilding the leaves rustling overhead. She sat up, resmoothing the skirt that had hiked up in her sleep, revealing lacy white garters and ruined silk stockings. "Don't do that on my account." Isabel glanced to her left and saw Gaetan coming toward her. For the first time, she saw him clearly. He was lanky, wiry as an apostrophe mark, and dressed in clothes that appeared to have come from a beggar's bin. Beneath a fraying cap, his face was scruffy and sharp, unshaven. He had a wide brow and a pronounced chin and deep-set gray eyes that were heavily lashed. The look in those eyes was as sharp as the point of his chin and revealed a kind of clarified hunger. Last night she thought it was how he'd looked at her. Now she saw that it was how he looked at the world. He didn't scare her, not at all. Isabel was not like her sister Vianne, who was given to fear and anxiety. But neither was Isabel a fool. If she was going to travel with this man, she had better get a few things straight. "So," she said, "prison." He stared at her, raised a black eyebrow as if to say, "Scared yet?" "A girl like you wouldn't know anything about it. I could tell you it was a Jean Valjean sort of stay, and you would think it was romantic." It was the kind of thing she heard all the time. It circled back to her looks, as most snide comments did. Surely a pretty blonde girl had to be shallow and dim-witted. "Were you stealing food to feed your family?" He grinned crookedly. It gave him a lopsided look, with one side of his smile hiking up farther than the other. "No." "Are you dangerous?" "It depends. What do you think of communists?" "Ah, so you were a political prisoner." "Something like that. But like I said, a nice girl like you wouldn't know anything about survival." "You'd be surprised the things I know, Gaetan. There is more than one kind of prison." "Is there, pretty girl? What do you know about it?" "What was your crime?" "I took things that didn't belong to me. Is that enough of an answer?" "Thief." "And you got caught?" "Obviously." "That isn't exactly comforting, Gaetan. Were you careless?" "Gait," he said, moving toward her, "I haven't decided if we're friends yet." He touched her hair, let a few strands coil around his dirty finger. "We're friends. Bank on it. Now let's go." When he reached for her hand, it occurred to her to refuse him, but she didn't. They walked out of the forest and back onto the road, merging once again into the crowd, which opened just enough to let them in and then closed around them. Isabel hung on to Gaetan with one hand and held her suitcase in the other. They walked for miles. Automobiles died around them. Cartwheels broke. Horses stopped and couldn't be made to move again. Isabel felt herself becoming listless and dull, exhausted by heat and dust and thirst. A woman limped along beside her, crying, her tears black with dirt and grit, and then that woman was replaced by an older woman in a fur coat who was sweating profusely and seemed to be wearing every piece of jewelry she owned. The sun grew stronger, became stiflingly, staggeringly hot. Children whined, women whimpered. The acrid, stuffy scent of body odor and sweat filled the air. But Isabel had grown so used to it that she barely noticed other people's smell or her own. It was almost 3 o'clock, the hottest part of the day, when they saw a regiment of French soldiers walking alongside them, dragging their rifles. The soldiers moved in a disorganized way, not in formation, not smartly. A tank rumbled beside them, crunching over belongings left in the road. On it, several wave-faced French soldiers sat slumped, their heads hung low. Isabel pulled free of Gaetan and stumbled through the crowd, elbowing her way to the regiment. "You're going the wrong way," she screamed, surprised to hear how hoarse her voice was.
Gaetan pounced on a soldier, shoved him back so hard he stumbled and crashed into a slow-moving tank. "Who is fighting for France?" The bleary-eyed soldier shook his head. "No one." In a glint of silver, Isabel saw the knife Gaetan held to the man's throat. The soldier's gaze narrowed. "Go ahead. Do it. Kill me." Isabel pulled Gaetan away. In his eyes, she saw a rage so deep it scared her. He could do it. He could kill this man by slitting his throat. And she thought, they opened the prisons. Was he worse than a thief? "Gaeth," she said. Her voice got through to him. He shook his head as if to clear it and lowered his knife. "Who is fighting for us?" he said bitterly, coughing at the dust. "We will be," she said, "soon." Behind her, an automobile honked its horns. "Au ouga." Isabel ignored it. Automobiles were no better than walking anymore. The few that were still running were moving only at the whim of the people around them, like flotsam in the reeds of a muddy river. "Come on." She pulled him away from the demoralized regiment. They walked on, still holding hands. But as the hours passed, Isabel noticed a change in Gaetan. He rarely spoke and didn't smile. At each town, the crowd thinned. People stumbled into Artenay, Saran, and Orleans, their eyes alight with desperation as they reached into handbags and pockets and wallets for money they hoped to be able to spend. Still, Isabel and Gaetan kept going. They walked all day and fell into exhausted sleep in the dark and woke again to walk the next day. By their third day, Isabel was numb with exhaustion. Oozing red blisters had formed between most of her toes and on the balls of her feet, and every step was painful. Dehydration gave her a terrible pounding headache, and hunger gnawed at her empty stomach. Dust clogged her throat and eyes and made her cough constantly. She stumbled past a freshly dug grave on the side of the road, marked by a crudely hammered together wooden cross. Her shoe caught on something, a dead cat, and she staggered forward, almost falling to her knees. Gaetan steadied her. She clung to his hand, remained stubbornly upright. How much later was it that she heard something? An hour? A day? Bees. They buzzed around her head. She batted them away. She licked her dried lips and thought of pleasant days in the garden, with bees buzzing about. No, not bees. She knew that sound. She stopped, frowning. Her thoughts were addled. What had she been trying to remember? The droning grew louder, filling the air. And then the aeroplanes appeared, 6 or 7 of them, looking like small crucifixes against the blue and cloudless sky. Isabel tented a hand over her eyes, watching the aeroplanes fly closer. Lower. Someone yelled, "It's the Borgias!" In the distance, a stone bridge exploded in a spray of fire and stone and smoke. The aeroplanes dropped lower over the crowd. Gaetan threw Isabel to the ground and covered her body with his. The world became pure sound, the roar of the aeroplanes' engines, the rat-a-tat-tat of machine gun fire, the beat of her heart, people screaming. Bullets ate up the grass and rose. People screamed and cried out. Isabel saw a woman fly into the air like a rag doll and hit the ground in a heap. Trees snapped in half and fell over. People yelled. Flames burst into existence. Smoke filled the air. And then, quiet. Gaetan rolled off her. "Are you all right?" he asked. She pushed the hair from her eyes and sat up. There were mangled bodies everywhere, and fires, and billowing black smoke. People were screaming, crying, dying. An old man moaned, "Help me." Isabel crawled to him on her hands and knees, realizing as she got close that the ground was marshy with his blood. A stomach wound gaped through his ripped shirt. Entrails bulged out of the torn flesh. "Maybe there's a doctor," was all she could think of to say, and then she heard it again, the droning. "They're coming back." Gaetan pulled her to her feet. She almost slipped in the blood-soaked grass. Not far away, a bomb hit, exploding into fire. Isabel saw a toddler in soiled nappies standing by a dead woman, crying. She stumbled toward the toddler. Gaetan yanked her sideways. "I have to help." "Your dying won't help that kid," he growled, pulling her so hard it hurt. She stumbled along beside him in a daze. They dodged discarded automobiles and bodies, most of which were ripped beyond repair, bleeding, bones sticking out through the their clothes. At the edge of town, Gaetan pulled Isabel into a small stone church. Others were already there, crouching in corners, hiding amid the pews, hugging their loved ones close. Aeroplanes roared overhead, accompanied by the stuttering shriek of machine guns. The stained glass window shattered. Bits of colored glass clattered to the floor, slicing through skin on the way down. Timbers cracked. Dust and stones fell. Bullets ran across the church, nailing arms and legs to the floor. The altar exploded. Gaetan said something to her, and she answered. Or she thought she did, but she wasn't sure, and before she could figure it out, another bomb whistled, fell, and the roof over her head exploded. Chapter 7. The École Élémentaire was not a big school by city standards, but it was spacious and well laid out, plenty large enough for the children of the commune of Caraveau. Before its life as a school, the building had been stables for a rich landowner, and thus its U-shaped design. The central courtyard had been a gathering place for carriages and tradesmen. It boasted gray stone walls, bright blue shutters, and wooden floors. The manor house, to which it had once been aligned, had been bombed in the Great War and never rebuilt. Like so many schools in the small towns in France, it stood on the far edge of town. Vianne was in her classroom, behind her desk, staring out at the shining children's faces in front of her, dabbing her upper lip with her wrinkled handkerchief. On the floor by each child's desk was the obligatory gas mask. Children now carried them everywhere. The open windows and thick stone walls helped to keep the sun at bay, but still the heat was stifling. Lord knew it was hard enough to concentrate without the added burden of the heat. The news from Paris was terrible, terrifying. All anyone could talk about was the gloomy future and the shocking present. Germans in Paris. The Maginot Line broken. French soldiers deep in trenches and running from the front. For the last 3 nights, since a telephone call from her father, she hadn't slept. Isabel was God knew where between Paris and Caraveau, and there had been no word from Antoine. "Who wants to conjugate the verb courir for me?" she asked tiredly. "Shouldn't we be learning German?" Vianne realized what she'd just been asked. The students were interested now, sitting upright, their eyes bright. "Pardon," she said, clearing her throat, buying time. "We should be learning German, not French." It was young Gilles Cornier, the butcher's son. His father and all three of his older brothers had gone off to the war, leaving only him and his mother to run the family's butcher shop. "And shooting," Francois agreed, nodding his head. "My maman says we will need to know how to shoot Germans, too." "My grandmère says we should all just leave," said Claire. "She remembers the last war, and she said we are fools for staying." "The Germans won't cross the Loire, will they, Madame Mauriac?" In the front row center, Sophie sat forward in her seat, her hands clasped atop the wooden desk, her eyes wide. She had been as upset by the rumors as Vianne. The child had cried herself to sleep 2 nights in a row, worrying over her father. Now Bébé came to school with her. Sarah sat in the desk beside her best friend, looking equally fearful. "It is all right to be afraid," Vianne said, moving toward them. It was what she said to Sophie last night, and to herself, but the words rang hollow. "I'm not afraid," Gil said. "I got a knife. I'll kill any dirty Bochers who show up in Caraveau." Sarah's eyes widened. "They're coming here?" "No," Vianne said. The denial didn't come easily. Her own fear caught at the words, stretched it out. "The French soldiers, your fathers and uncles and brothers, are the bravest men in the world. I'm sure they are fighting for Paris and Tours and Orléans, even as we speak." "But Paris is overrun," Gil said. "What happened to the French soldiers at the front?" "In wars there are battles and skirmishes, losses along the way, but our men will never let the Germans win. We will never give up." She moved closer to her students. "But we have a part to play, too. Those of us left behind, we have to be brave and strong, too, and not believe the worst. We have to keep on with our lives, so our fathers and brothers and husbands have lives to come home to. We..." "But what about Tante Isabel?" Sophie said. "Grandpère said she should have been here by now." My cousin ran from Paris too, Francois said. He has not arrived here either. My uncle says it is bad on the roads. The bell rang, and students popped from their seats like springs. In an instant, the war, the aeroplanes, the fear were forgotten. They were 8 and 9-year-olds, freed at the end of a summer school day, and they acted like it, yelling, laughing, talking all at once, pushing one another aside, running for the door. Vianne was thankful for the bell. She was a teacher, for God's sakes. What did she know to say about dangers such as these? How could she assuage a child's fear when her own was straining at the leash? She busied herself with ordinary tasks, gathering up the detritus that 16 children left behind, banging chalk from the soft erasers, putting books away. When everything was as it should be, she put her papers and pencils into her own leather satchel and took her handbag out of the desk's bottom drawer. Then she put on her straw hat, pinned it in place, and left her classroom. She walked down the quiet hallways, waving to colleagues who were still in their classrooms. Several of the rooms were closed up now that the male teachers had been mobilized. At Rachel's classroom, she paused, watching as Rachel put her son in his pram and wheeled it toward the door. Rachel had been planning to take this term off from teaching to stay home with Ari, but the war had changed all of that. Now she had no choice but to bring her baby to work with her. "You look like I feel," Vianne said as her friend neared. Rachel's dark hair had responded to the humidity and doubled in size. "That can't be a compliment, but I'm desperate, so I'm taking it as one. You have chalk on your cheek, by the way." Vianne wiped her cheek absently and leaned over the pram. The baby was sleeping soundly. "How's he doing?" "For a 10-month-old who is supposed to be at home with his maman and is instead gallivanting around town beneath enemy aeroplanes and listening to 10-year-old students shriek all day? Fine." She smiled and pushed a damp ringlet from her face as they headed down the corridor. "Do I sound bitter?" "No more than the rest of us." "Ha! Bitterness would do you good. All that smiling and pretending of yours would give me hives." Rachel bumped the pram down the 3 stone steps and onto the walkway that led to the grassy play area that had once been an exercise arena for horses and a delivery area for tradesmen. A 400-year-old stone fountain gurgled and dripped water in the center of the yard. "Come on, girls," Rachel called out to Sophie and Sarah, who were sitting together on a park bench. The girls responded immediately and fell into step ahead of the women, chattering constantly, their heads cocked together, their hands clasped, a second generation of best friends. They turned into an alleyway and came out on Rue Victor Hugo, right in front of a bistro where old men sat on ironwork chairs, drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes and talking politics. Ahead of them, Vianne saw a haggard trio of women limping along, their clothes tattered, their faces yellow with dust. "Poor women," Rachel said with a sigh. "Helene Riol told me this morning that at least a dozen refugees came to town late last night. The stories they bring are not good, but no one embellishes a story like Helene." Ordinarily, Vianne would make a comment about what a gossip Helene was, but she couldn't be glib. According to Papa, Isabelle had left Paris days ago. She still hadn't arrived at Le Jardin. "I'm worried about Isabelle," she said. Rachel linked her arm through Vianne's. "Do you remember the first time your sister ran away from that boarding school in Lyon? She was 7 years old. She made it all the way to Amboise, alone, with no money. She spent 2 nights in the woods and talked her way onto the train." Vianne barely remembered anything of that time except for her own grief. When she'd lost the first baby, she'd fallen into despair. The lost year, Antoine called it. That was how she thought of it, too. When Antoine told her he was taking Isabelle to Paris and to Papa, Vianne had been, God help her, relieved. Was it any surprise that Isabelle had run away from the boarding school to which she'd been sent? To this day, Vianne felt an abiding shame at how she had treated her baby sister. "She was 9 the first time she made it to Paris," Vianne said, trying to find comfort in the familiar story. "Isabelle was tough and driven and determined. She'd always had been. If I'm not mistaken, she was expelled 2 years later for running away from school to see a traveling circus. Or was that when she climbed out of the second-floor dormitory window using a bedsheet? Rachel smiled. The point is, Isabel will make it here if that's what she wants. God help anyone who tries to stop her. She will arrive any day, I promise, unless she has met an exiled prince and fallen desperately in love. That is the kind of thing that could happen to her. You see, Rachel teased, you feel better already. Now, come to my house for lemonade. It's just the thing on a day this hot. After supper, Vian got Sophie settled into bed and went downstairs. She was too worried to relax. The silence in her house kept reminding her that no one had come to her door. She could not remain still. Regardless of her conversation with Rachel, she couldn't dispel her worry and a terrible sense of foreboding about Isabel. Vian stood up, sat down, then stood again and walked to the front door, opening it. Outside, the fields lay beneath a purple and pink evening sky. Her yard was a series of familiar shapes. Well-tended apple trees stood protectively between the front door and the rose and vine-covered stone wall, beyond which lay the road to town and acres of fields studded here and there with thickets of narrow-trunked trees. Off to the right was the deeper woods where she and Antoine had often sneaked off to be alone when they were younger. Antoine. Isabel. Where were they? Was he at the front? Was she walking from Paris? Don't think about it. She needed to do something. Gardening. Keep her mind on something else. After retrieving her worn gardening gloves and stepping into the boots by the door, she made her way to the garden, positioned on a flat patch of land between the shed and the barn. Potatoes, onions, carrots, broccoli, peas, beans, cucumbers, tomatoes, and radishes grew in its carefully tended beds. On the hillside, between the garden and the barn, were the berries, raspberries and blackberries in carefully contained rows. She knelt down in the rich black dirt and began pulling weeds. Early summer was usually a time of promise. Certainly, things could go wrong in this most ardent season, but if one remained steady and calm and didn't shirk the all-important duties of weeding and thinning, the plants could be guided and tamed. Vian always made sure that the beds were precisely organized and tended with a firm yet gentle hand. Even more important than what she gave her garden was what it gave her. In it, she found a sense of calm. She became aware of something wrong slowly, in pieces. First, there was a sound that didn't belong, a vibration, a thudding, and then a murmur. The odors came next, something wholly at odds with her sweet garden smell, something acrid and sharp that made her think of decay. Vian wiped her forehead, aware that she was smearing black dirt across her skin, and stood up. Tucking her dirty gloves in the gaping hip pockets of her pants, she rose to her feet and moved toward her gate. Before she reached it, a trio of women appeared, as if sculpted out of the shadows. They stood, clumped together in the road just behind her gate. An old woman, dressed in rags, held the others close to her, a young woman with a babe in arms, and a teenage girl who held an empty birdcage in one hand and a shovel in the other. Each looked glassy-eyed and feverish. The young mother was clearly trembling. Their faces were dripping with sweat. Their eyes were filled with defeat. The old woman held out dirty, empty hands. "Can you spare some water?" she asked. But even as she asked her the question, she looked unconvinced, beaten. Vian opened the gate. "Of course. Would you like to come in? Sit down, perhaps?" The old woman shook her head. "We are ahead of them. There's nothing for those in the back." Vian didn't know what the woman meant, but it didn't matter. She could see that the women were suffering from exhaustion and hunger. Just a moment. She went into the house and packed them some bread and raw carrots and a small bit of cheese, all that she had to spare. She filled a wine bottle with water and returned, offering them the provisions. "It's not much," she said. "It's more than we've had since Tours," the young woman said in a toneless voice. "You were in Tours?" Vian asked. "Drink, Sabine," the old woman said, holding the water to the girl's lips. Vian was about to ask about Isabel when the old woman said sharply, "They're here." The young mother made a moaning sound and tightened her hold on the baby, who was so quiet and its tiny fist so blue that Vian gasped. The baby was dead. Vian knew about the kind of talon grief that wouldn't let go. She had fallen into the fathomless gray that warped a mind and made a mother keep holding on long after hope was gone. "Go inside," the old woman said to Bian. "Lock your doors." But the ragged trio backed away, lurked really, as if Bian's breath had become noxious. And then she saw the mass of black shapes moving across the field and coming up the road. The smell preceded them, human sweat and filth and body odor. As they neared, the miasma of black separated, peeled into forms. She saw people on the road and in the fields, walking, limping, coming toward her. Some were pushing bicycles or prams or dragging wagons. Dogs barked. Babies cried. There was coughing, throat clearing, whining. They came forward through the field and up the road, relentlessly moving closer, pushing one another aside, their voices rising. We have come to the end of the book hour in today's reading of The Nightingale by Kristen Hannah. The preceding program was a production of Sight into Sound Radio.